Okay, we're going to call the Senate Finance meeting to order. Today is March 11th, times 9:05. We have Senator Kelly, Co-Chairman Kelly, excuse me, Senator Olson, Senator Hoffman, and Senator Dunleavy, Senator Bishop, welcome back.
Thank you.
And Vice Chair Faircloth, so we have the full committee today. It's my understanding Senate Bill 138 is not going to be taken up this morning, so if you're here for the gas bill, come back this evening. So today we're going to continue our discussion on Senate Bill 64, which is the Omnibus Crime Bill. We have not taken public testimony on that bill yet, so that's what we'd like to do today. But before we hear from the public, I'd like to ask Senator Coghill, Staff Jordan, if you would join us, please. Jordan, don't mean to put you on the spot, but I just wanted to give you an opportunity to, if there's any additional comments you wanted to make on Senate Bill 64 before we begin the public testimony, now would be a good opportunity.
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Mr. Chairman, no additional comments. Just thanks for opening up to public testimony.
Okay, very good. Well, after the public testimony, if there's additional questions, you'll be here, I take it? Okay, very good. All right, then, let's go right to the public testimony then. We'll start Fairbanks with Shirley Lee with the Tanana Chiefs Conference. Shirley, are you with us? And normally what we like to do is try to leave the or have the public testimony somewhere about 2 to 3 minutes, so if you can be concise in your comments, that's very helpful. So Shirley, the floor is yours. Maybe.
Good morning. My name is Shirley Lee. I'm the chairperson of the Tanana Chiefs Conference Justice Task Force, and I'm here in support of SB 64. The 42 tribes of and tribal organizations of Tanana Chiefs Conference, representing some 15,000 members, are meeting this week here in Fairbanks at our annual convention. And at our convention, we address concerns and issues affecting our people. One such issue that has continually come up is the disproportionate number of our Native men who are incarcerated. In years past, Tanana Chiefs has called for the creation of a prison here in Interior Alaska so that we might assist in the rehabilitation of our tribal members through culturally appropriate programming. Today, we see the reform philosophy shifting from that of building new prisons to rehabilitation efforts. We support any efforts to do so, and SB 64 provides such a vehicle. We applaud the intent of SB 64 and the use of innovative programming. It is a good start to much-needed criminal justice reform. We also appreciate the inclusion of many voices on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. We hope this will have greater partnership with tribes in the justice area in the future. So in summary, Tanana Chiefs Conference is here in support of SB 64. Thank you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Shirley. Appreciate your comments. Okay, let's go here to Juno Heather Szymanski. I'm sorry, Heather. Well, you'll correct me, Heather. Heather, if you could put your name on the record for me, please.
And Heather Szymanski.
I'm sorry?
Heather Szymanski.
Szymanski. Well, that's pretty close. Okay, Heather, go ahead.
Hi, I just want to thank you for supporting Bill 64, and I'm here to share with you my personal story. I am a felon, and I am still on felony probation. I've been clean and sober since October 15th of 2008. During my incarceration, I did the RSAT program, which treated and addressed my addiction problems. After being released in 2011, there were a number of different reentry services that were offered to me in Anchorage to include like an intensive outpatient treatment, and then a women's support group. And then I also lived in the transitional housing, and this was all for a period of 1 year. I was released in 2011, and I have never had a parole violation. So, you know, when you get out of jail, there's a lot of stuff going on. Like, I had a hard time finding a job, and I had to find housing, and I know for a fact that without these services, I wouldn't be here today. Thanks.
Great. Heather, we have a question for you, Senator Kelly.
Heather, congratulations on being sober that long. Good work. And we just thank you. When people get their lives together and take the effort to become better people, we all benefit. And I'm sure I speak for the people on this committee. Thanks for doing that.
Thank you. Thank you, Heather. Okay, Catherine? Catherine Chapman? Morning, Catherine.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Catherine Chapman, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. For me, that means that I have not used drugs or alcohol since May 2nd, 2010.
Congratulations.
Because I got clean and sober, I was able to finish my master's degree in social work from the University of Alaska Anchorage, and I've been able to be a productive member of our community. I'm the executive director for the Juno affiliate of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Dependence, and I get to serve a leadership role in our Juno Reentry Coalition. I'm here today to thank you for sponsoring Senate Bill 64 and for supporting efforts toward implementing and funding programs that help ex-offenders to be successful, such as the 24/7 sobriety and PACE programs. These are good programs. The studies show that they improve public safety, they're cost-effective, and they reduce recidivism. I want to talk to you a little bit about our coalition and then talk about recovery and what recovery is for me and for the people that I work with. Because when I hear people talk about reentry, I'm hearing them talk about recovery. So our Juno Reentry Coalition is made up of members of people who are in recovery, who've been involved in the criminal justice system. There's also professionals who work in the substance abuse, mental health field, in housing, education, employment. There's representatives from the Department of Corrections who also serve on our coalition. Some common themes. There's so many things that we talk about because, as you know, reentry is complicated. There are a lot of pieces to reentry, but I just wanted to name the top three things that are reoccurring themes, and those are one, the lack of safe and sober housing for people who are coming out of jail. Two, there are not enough substance abuse residential services that are long-term in our state, in our communities. And three, the need for more peer support services where like-minded people can support and help each other. We all know that many of our ex-offenders are people with substance abuse disorders, often untreated. The Senate Bill 64, I saw, also includes an expanded risks assessment that would be required for people incarcerated for 30 days or more. I think that this is a really good thing. People have different needs. People like mental health or substance abuse or other brain disorders. And so this is a very positive direction. Just quickly to finish up, when I think about reentry, like I said, I think about recovery. Addiction is the problem and recovery is the solution. For me, as a person in recovery, I can tell you that I've been blessed. I'm privileged. I'm educated. I have support systems. In 2010, I was in the depth of my alcoholism, and I did some awful things, and I ended up getting charged with two felonies and ended up being convicted of four misdemeanors, but I had to serve my sentence. I went to Lemon Creek for 10 days, served my sentence for 5.5 months at the halfway house, where I was able to finish my master's degree in social work. So I got great insight into this problem, into the people, into the recidivism, and the cycling, which brings me here today. I'm passionate about this. For the people who don't have support systems, family, clean, safe, sober housing to go back into, they're not going to succeed. I had all of that, and even for me, my recovery was really still hard to maintain, and it continues to be every day. It's something I have to work out. I have to work my program, which means good nutrition, exercise, maintaining a spiritual connection, to remind me that I am an alcoholic and I have this disease, and I have to stay grounded and be reminded of that so I can do the next right thing. So it's ongoing. I mean, it's been almost 4 years. It's ongoing. It takes a long time. I didn't even think I had a problem until like a year and a half into my sobriety. Then I started to like accept that I had a problem. So anything you can do to support programs for reentry, you're supporting recovery, you're saving lives, and you're gonna help people contribute back and give back to the community like I am here today. So thank you for what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you. Really appreciate that. It's powerful testimony. Senator Hoffman has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is one provision of this legislation that deals with monetary values of stolen property and that level becoming a felony. And the range in the United States is from 200 to 2,500. And I'm wondering if you have an opinion as to what the state of Alaska should have for this level.
It is my opinion that the level you're proposing to increase to 2,500, is that what you're saying?
I don't think it is. No, that's the range.
Oh, the range?
From 500 in Virginia to 2,500 in Indiana. And I believe the one in here is $500 for the state of Alaska.
$750,
yeah.
It's my opinion it should be increased. From my knowledge, based on what I know, that amount was set years ago. So the value of things right now, I mean, an iPad is, I'm just thinking of how expensive things are, you know. It would be my opinion to increase it.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Catherine. Okay, that's it. That's good. Thanks. All right, we'll move on now to stay here in Juneau, Kevin. Kevin Inloy, I'm sorry. I got the Kevin right. Amazing, huh? Okay, Kevin, if you could put your name on the record, please.
My name is Kevin Inloy, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. I've been clean for 3 years and 3 months since, let's see, December 12th, 2010. I just recently got out of prison. Again, I have an extensive career in prison and drug usage. It spans back about 20 years. And with that, I have had 4 felony charges, 12 misdemeanor charges, and 55 drop charges. All of them are drug-related. And this spans all the way back to minor consuming when I was 13. And when I was 13, I got my first minor consuming, and I was ordered to take an 8-hour class, which I did, and I think I slept through most of it and, you know, ate what they gave and went home. But there was no, like, follow-up or aftercare or anything that really dealt with the impending addiction that I was going through. Out of all those charges and jail sentences, not once was I ever offered or ordered to take a treatment program. And in Lemon Creek, there's one that's on hold right now. And I did probably 12 years, all of it at Lemon Creek. And finally, last year, there was a program, an LSAT program, which I took. But it didn't seem to be long enough. All these times that I've attempted to get sober, everything was really short. And there was no follow-up, no aftercare programming, and really no checks and balances. So, you know, I might dry out and clean up, but I had no follow-up and start working on, like, the mental recovery and health and the cultural and social rebuilding. You know, I mean, through that whole life, you have a whole group of people that you hang out with, and your whole society is, you know, a certain area, the dark side. And it takes a long time to change that whole thing and change everybody you know. Plus, there's the stigma that's involved with it that kind of prevents you from moving forward. Anyway, I applaud that this is coming onto the table and that there's possibly money going into reentry programs and to treatment and hopefully more long-term treatment programs. It's the aftercare that becomes the most important part. I mean, the getting sober is one aspect of it, but it's the small aspect. It's all that work that comes afterwards, and it takes years. It doesn't happen in a month. And these services need to be, you know, applicable at that time, because there's a small window when you decide, okay, I need to get help, and you ask for help. And if that help isn't there or you know, available, you slide back into your subculture. And it's nice to finally see all these things. What did it for me is, after all those years of being involved and attempting to get, you know, help, I was able to like piece together all the different services from everywhere. It would have been nice at one point to have all this stuff under one, you know, umbrella corporation, but everything was pieced together and put together. And I had to search out my own aftercare and find it. And to this day, there are some classes and courses, and NAs and AAs do help. But sometimes we need more interactive, you know, classes, which are great, you know. And you know, I look forward to seeing what kind of, you know, aftercare and treatment facility happens, and, you know, men's sober living and women's sober living. I mean, that's a huge problem coming out. I don't know how many times they came out of jail, nowhere to go, nothing to do, and no safe place. So I ended up back on the couches of the wrong side. And it took going to prison for a few years, and surprisingly, my support system came from correctional officers and the maintenance department. I had done so much time, they became my family, my support group, and really pushed towards my recovery and helped me stay in an area where I could focus on that stuff, and prevented me from getting transferred to a bigger penitentiary, to, you know, where I could probably slide back further, you know, into the subculture. So, you know, I applaud this, you know, committee for putting money towards that and putting focus towards that, and, you know, I hope that it continues on.
Great, Kevin. Thank you for your testimony. I don't see any questions. Thank you. Glad you're with us. Okay. Christina Love?
Hello, I'm Christina Love.
Hi, Christina.
Thank you guys for listening. I'm here supporting Senate Bill 64. I'm a little bit nervous because I can only share my experience, but I'm speaking for all of the addicts that I've helped. I'm speaking for all of the women that I've worked with at the Aware Shelter, and for all the people that I've helped that are homeless. And the underlying thing has been, in my experience, has been addiction. For the services that have helped me. 3 years ago, I tried to kill myself because I didn't think that there was a way out of addiction. I was too shameful to talk about it. And my family didn't talk about it either. My uncle was a professor at UAA, and he died from alcoholism. And I didn't know that till later on. It would be another year before I made it to detox, and then the waiting list to get into treatment was too long, so I ended up relapsing, and then I did outpatient services. And for those, they did help me because it planted that seed that there was a way out. And what I've learned in recovery is that sobriety is the catalyst for recovery, that it wasn't a moral issue. For years, I spent time thinking about how I could fix myself, what's wrong with me, you know, and the message that I try to convey to addicts today is that it is a disease and that it can be arrested and that there is hope. The services that have really helped me, when I came out of treatment, we had to move back to where we were living before, and a drug dealer lived right next door. So through the probation office, we were able to get TBRA that gave us funding for housing, so that we were able to move out and to get our own place that wasn't surrounded by some of the things that really contributed to our addiction. For me, community and support has been one of the biggest things. And some of the things that I've really struggled with helping fellow addicts in recovery is that timing, you know, getting them into treatment. I was really fortunate that I had family to help me along the way. When I got out of detox, it would be another 30 days before I could go to treatment. And there was a doctor there that advised me to get the Vivitrol shot because I physically couldn't stop doing drugs and alcohol. And that bought me time until I got into treatment. But then even after treatment, trying to get outpatient services, you know, something that I couldn't afford, or my partner. I really hope that learning to speak in front of you guys is totally different from speaking at AA and NA meetings. And my message is how important this is. For me, this is life and death. And for the addicts that I help, it's life and death. And you're not just helping me, you're helping my family. You're helping my daughter. And for the people that I help, you're helping them and their family. I 100% support this. And if there's any way that we could come together and figure out more programs, more money, the problem isn't as overwhelming as it seems. The statistics are ridiculous. It's crazy. But for me, it's pretty simple. We need more recovery houses and treatment centers and community support. Thank you.
Great, Christina. Thank you for that testimony. And glad you're sober and with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Let's see. Was there anybody else here in Juneau before I go offline? A couple folks. Ron Taylor here for questions. And then Suzanne DiPietro, questions. If you wanted to testify, though, come on up. Okay. Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to make a comment before our guests leave the room here today. I just want to reiterate Senator Kelly's comments and yours, Mr. Chairman, and others around the table. You couldn't convince me that you're nervous and speak in front of this crowd, because I think all of you have been very articulate and your command of the King's English is excellent. And I just applaud you on what you're doing and the guts it takes to come up here and talk about your trials and tribulations, and you've got my full support. I think everybody's here at this table. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Kelly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to the folks that testified here, would you do me a favor and stop by my office and talk with that lady right there? And there's a program called Set Free Alaska, and I don't know if you're familiar with it, but they have a very high success rate with addiction counseling, and it's based on a slightly different premise maybe than you've heard before, and each one of you had identified yourselves as an addict or an alcoholic or something like that, and I understand the 12-step programs, and I keep going with those, don't get me wrong. But I'd like to invite you to believe something, and that is this. That is a lie. You are not an alcoholic. You are not an addict. You are a child of God, and you'll beat this, okay?
Okay. Thank you, Senator Kelly. Okay, we're going to go to the various off-net sites. Let's start in Anchorage, Tony Piper.
Yes, I'm here.
Tony, yes, if you could, yes. Please, thank you for joining us this morning. If you could, just state your name and your affiliation, and then proceed with your testimony.
My name is Tony Piper. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Service, the ASAP program manager, and I'm really just here to answer questions, if there are any.
Oh, okay. Yep. I see there's a question mark next to your name. We didn't know if you wanted to testify or answer questions. Okay. All right. Well, very good. Then we'll just keep you online in case there are some questions. Is that the same with Quinlan Steiner, with the public defender? Questions, or did you want to testify, Quinlan?
Mr. Chairman, this is Quinlan Steiner with Public Defender. I'm just here available for questions.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Quinlan, for joining us. Let's then go to Chris Nettles with NFIB, and I believe you do want to testify. Is that right, Chris?
Yes, sir. My name is Chris Nettles, and I'm president of Geotech Alaska here in Anchorage. And I'm calling on behalf of the National Federation of Independent Businesses and myself and company. We are concerned in particular about the felony theft rate, which I think is now at 750. I was against it being raised to 750. However, I'm willing with the National Federation of Independent Businesses to compromise to 750. But I believe that going any higher than 750 for this theft rate is a mistake. It will cost small businesses money. We have had an increased number of thefts going on at our business in Anchorage, and I've seen it become more bold in the past, and particularly just in January had attempts at stealing quite a bit of stuff from our yard and shop. And I am, like I said, dead set against going any higher. I believe that will just invite more theft and crime in Anchorage.
Chris, yeah, I'm glad you called in. I do have a question, and certainly theft in our businesses is a concern, and it impacts all of us because it forces you then to raise the prices to cover those things that are shoplifted. But do you think when somebody shoplifts that they know the difference between a felony versus a misdemeanor, and that, you know, if I keep it under $500, it's just a misdemeanor, and if I go over $500, it's a felony? I guess I'm just trying to visualize in a criminal's mind if they really rationalize that much.
Well, I think they're well aware of it. But in terms of what we have, we're not shoplifting. We have actually we do construction work and that kind of thing, and we'll have them come take tools. And I know that they do this fairly common to have them come around on a Saturday night when people are not at the shop or the yard, not active. We'll see I've seen numerous. I've actually been there when someone came and took stuff out of the yard before I could catch them and drove off with it. There's no doubt that these individuals that are going around on the weekend nights within Anchorage know what they're doing and would know the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor. Now, again, under the misdemeanor charge. However, we've had attempts at stealing way more than $500 or $750. So there are some pros out there who certainly know the felony rates. The younger ones regarding shoplifting, that kind of thing, I don't know. But I can tell you that certainly if I were an owner of like a Fred Meyers or something like that, certainly the prices of things have gone up, but there's also things like computers and whatnot have come down in price. So stealing a computer or stealing a TV, as far as I'm concerned, is still theft, and that ought to be dealt with in a fairly strict manner.
Okay. We have a question, Senator Kelly.
Actually, it's not a question, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to, and I could probably hold it until the sponsor is going to come up to the
table. Okay. Why don't you hold it? Okay. Senator Fricklef has a question for you, Chris.
Sure.
Chris, thanks for joining us. One of the challenges that we have is we're getting ready to draw $2 billion from our savings account, and we're trying to assess the state investment in what we're doing. And when we see that we're in a lower one-third of the rest of the states as far as where we currently stand at at a $500 threshold, we're trying to analyze where that should go up. And I understand what you've told us. In your experience as a business owner, if someone steals something from you, is it above the $500,000 or $500 threshold?
No, not necessarily. We've had, you know, both. We've had stuff coming under the $500. I would say the majority are probably under the $500 in terms of the numbers that have come and stolen things. However, like I said, we've had also, attempts to steal, like, for instance, trailers. Just not more than 2 weeks ago, we had someone chopping at our chains that held our trailers down, and, were caught, essentially, in the act of doing that and ran off. But we're literally, and then we've had trucks parked out in front of the parking lot that have had hoods popped and stolen the catalytic converters out of them. And in other words, they damaged the truck to get to the part that they wanted out of it. I don't know the cost of all those things. I don't know what a catalytic converter is worth on the street, but I can tell you that those kinds of things are occurring, and they're occurring more so in the last probably 2 to 3 years than we've been in business for a little over 10 years in Anchorage, and I've seen in the last 2 to 3 years quite a bit more increase in that activities.
Anything else, Senator Fricklef?
Mr. Chairman, my only thought is that it's still a crime. The issue is whether it's a felony and it goes through felony courts versus a misdemeanor, which would be a different system for the judge to consider. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you for joining us, Chris.
Thank you.
Okay, Carmen Gutierrez.
Good morning, Chairman Meyer. For the record, my name is Carmen Gutierrez, and I'm here testifying as an Alaska citizen. And in terms of my background, I've worked in the criminal justice system for about 25 years, most recently as Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. And my responsibilities when I was with the department was to work on prisoner rehabilitative programs and improve prisoner reentry outcomes. I'm testifying in support of SB 64, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to provide what I hope will be very brief and to-the-point comments. The people working behind the scenes on SB 64 have been doing so since the fall of 2012. And the motivation behind SB 64 was to do what policymakers could do to try to improve the value that Alaskans are receiving for the criminal justice dollars spent. Because I think it's pretty much beyond refute that when two out of three Alaskans return to prison within 3 years of their release from custody, we can probably fairly safely assume that Alaskans are not getting very good value for the criminal justice dollars spent. So the issue became, especially when I was had the great privilege of serving the state as deputy commissioner, was try to really figure out what it was that we could do that would provide better outcomes in our criminal justice system. And the great news is that many, many other states, because of dire fiscal situations that they were facing, started to get very, very serious about looking at their criminal justice systems and trying to figure out how they too could get a better value for the dollars spent. And as a result of that, a lot of research was done on programs that worked, research was done on programs that didn't work. States started to look at their programs and those that were not getting good value and good outcomes. Those were basically eliminated, and proven evidence-based approaches started to be implemented in many, many different states. And there's now all sorts of research, and I think that Jordan Schilling from Senator Cotto's office has offered you a lot of information about many of the programs that other states have implemented that are not only reducing recidivism, but they're also reducing the amount of criminality in their state. And that means their prison population growth is declining, and that means the money that they are projecting to spend on prison construction is also declining. And so when we saw what other states were doing that was really showing how new strategies could provide better outcomes, we started looking at those strategies for Alaska, and that brought us PACE, that comes from the Hawaii HOPE model, Sobriety 24/7, learning that rehabilitative programs really do work if they are constantly reassessed for quality control and making sure that there's implementation that is consistently working. And I think the good news is that this year Deputy Commissioner Taylor was able to provide this committee and other committees with testimony showing that now DOC's rehabilitative programs are starting to show some very, very positive outcomes. So we know from the evidence that's developing from DOC that our rehabilitative programs work. But I think really what is most important is we know from the testimony of the people preceding me that recovery works. If there are aftercare programs and support systems in place that will support these individuals upon the release from custody and as they move their way back into their communities. I'd like to comment just briefly on the purpose of the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission. As I indicated earlier, there's lots and lots of research that is showing what programs work, what programs don't, how to implement them, and how to provide ongoing quality assurance in making sure your programs are being run effectively. I respectfully submit that if we do not have some kind of entity like the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission, I'm not sure who in our criminal justice system will be taking the leadership role in trying to present to policymakers evidence and research on what's working and what's not working so that our policymakers, you folks, are in a position to make hopefully the most informed decisions on which directions you want to take when you're asked to make decisions on new programs and new strategies to reduce recidivism in Alaska. And so I really believe that there is a great role that could be served by the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission should you find it appropriate for the kind of research that is embodied in SB 64 to continue into the future. And lastly, I'd like to say that the work that you are doing in this community is going to have, I think, a profound effect on our community because, first of all, and most importantly, for every individual who is released from prison, who is successfully reentered into his or his community, essentially means one less victim. And when we reduce victimization in Alaska, we create healthier, stronger communities. I also think that there is a very, very important workforce development component to the work that is being done by this committee and the strategies that are being employed in SB 64. I think that with the strategies being employed in this bill, we are taking new, innovative, proven steps to reduce, that will ultimately reduce our prison population growth. I heard recently during the testimony in another committee that the new $250 million Goose Creek Correctional Facility is at 96% capacity. If we do not implement new proven strategies, I am very concerned that the state's rate of prison population will continue to grow at its very high rate. And lastly, I think the strategies employed in SB 64 have been proven in other communities to reduce recidivism, and to the extent that we can be more successful at that, I believe that Alaskans will be better served with the criminal justice dollars spent. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Okay, thank you, Carmen. Appreciate your testimony this morning. Lisa Rieger with the Cook Inlet Tribal Council.
Hi. For the record, my name is Lisa Rieger, and I am the General Counsel for Cook Inlet Tribal Council. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today, Chairman Meyer and the other senators of the committee. As many of you are aware, Cook Inlet Tribal Council has been operating one of the alternative programs for prisoner reentry for the past 6 or 7 years, and I had the great privilege and opportunity to be on the statewide reentry task force as these different options that have become part of Senate Bill 64 were debated and implemented across the spectrum of service providers and agencies that are addressing this really significant and important issue for our state. We speak in support of Senate Bill 64 and its objectives to cut correction spending and ensure public safety. And I guess I want to speak specifically to the new programs that are part of that bill, the 24/7 sobriety program, the PACE program, and the establishment of the Recidivism Reduction Fund to promote transitional reentry programs. I want to emphasize that what our experience has been in our program has been that it's much harder to actually want to change, and I think you heard that from the previous people who testified before the committee. It's actually much harder to go through a program and change than it is to sit and do time in prison. And so this is a really important opportunity to not only change individuals, but change our whole community. And we have probably, we've saved the state millions and millions of dollars because of the men who have been in our program instead of being in jail. And so it does save corrections money, but it most importantly it changes lives in our community. And I can speak more specifically if anybody has any questions, but I just wanted to emphasize our support for the bill, our support for also the section that really allows different types of alternative programs to substitute for prison time because they are harder than doing the prison time would be itself.
Great, Lisa, thank you for your testimony. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Pleasure.
Yep. And let's go now to Jeff Jesse. Jeff, you're usually here in Juneau, but we welcome your phone call. Jeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'll be down tomorrow morning again. For the record, my name is Jeff Jesse. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and I'm testifying in favor of Senate Bill 64. The Senate Bill 64 contains a number of targeted strategies in an effort to focus on what we can do in the short run to try to turn the curve on our rate of recidivism and incarceration. It's hard to improve on the testimony of the people that came earlier in the hearing about the effect that they have been able to gain from treatment programs and other supports in the community. The things that stand out to us about Senate Bill 64 are the expansion of the probation and parole accountability with certain enforcement, the PACE program. This is a proven evidence-based strategy originally in Hawaii and with some success here in Alaska as well. It basically ensures that a short leash will be kept on people who are on probation so that if they do have a problem, they are immediately faced with some measured consequences. The expanded risk needs assessment is also very important. That allows us to get a better handle on what situations people who are coming into corrections have, enables us to more finely tune a set of strategies to work with them, not only while they're in corrections, but as you've heard, even more importantly, what supports are available to them when they leave the department. The Recidivism Reduction Fund is an innovative strategy to try to create a funding mechanism to support transitional reentry programs. This is also, as you've heard, critical to reducing our recidivism. The bill would also expand the 24/7 alcohol monitoring program, again an evidence-based practice that assists people in staying sober, which, of course, is a major driver of not only criminal behavior but recidivism as well. I know there's some controversy over raising the felony threshold. I certainly can sympathize with businesses that are faced with thefts and other crimes against their businesses. I've been a victim of theft in my past as well, and it certainly is a disturbing event. However, there is a point at which you need to look at how you want to handle various levels of criminal behavior. I wish that our criminal element was as thoughtful and considered in their actions as some of the business interests would have us believe. Frankly, I am very doubtful that many criminals look at a thing that they want to steal and ponder whether it would come in over or under the $500 current threshold to be a felony or not. And I think that as inflation has changed the value of items, the statute needs to be changed to try to at least in part keep pace with that change in history. I know that the bill also contains the creation of a commission. Anytime you talk about creating yet another entity that consumes resources and time and effort, certainly there will be questions as to whether this is a good investment. In my view, in this particular circumstance, it is a worthwhile investment. As Carmen and others have testified, you are on a pace to create, build, and fund another prison in short order. The only way to avoid that is to invest in a series of strategies that would drive down the recidivism rate and avoid the need to further incarcerate more and more people over time. I believe that a commission such as that contemplated in SB 64 would be one important element of a comprehensive approach to recidivism. The House Finance Committee is considering some intent language that would encourage a number of agencies that currently do collaborate on recidivism issues, but would encourage them to develop more of a long-term plan and a portfolio of strategies such as Carmen Gutierrez mentioned. This would be the Departments of Labor, Alaska Housing Finance, Health and Social Services, Corrections, and the Trust. I think that although there is a lot of collaboration between those agencies right now, there isn't an overarching vision and plan that we can all bring back to the legislature and say, look, if you don't want to build additional prisons, if you want to support people in recovery, if you want to get people out of the cycle of criminality, these are the strategies that you should look at. These are the costs of those strategies, and this is the results that you should expect from implementing those strategies. I believe that that type of intent language would be very helpful in advancing this effort, and would encourage you to consider similar language on the Senate side as well. In my 34 years of working in this field, I've never seen the synergy that exists right now in the state, particularly around the issues of the impacts of alcohol and alcohol abuse on our state and our citizens. You have the Rasmussen-led Recover Alaska initiative. The Trust has identified alcohol and substance abuse as a focus area. The Mattsu Health Foundation has identified alcohol and its effects as a number one health problem in the Mattsu area. And, of course, Senator Kelly has been leading the Empowering Hope effort, and our tribal partners have worked diligently on this effort over time. If there was ever a time in the history of the state where I believe we have an opportunity to turn the curve on some of these issues, this is it. And if there was ever a time in the history of the state where the future financial viability of state services was at stake, looking forward to the prospective budgets that we'll have to work with, this is the time to get a handle on these issues, and we believe Senate Bill 64 is a fantastic start towards looking at a comprehensive approach to these issues. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate the comments. Okay, let's go on now to Stuart Greener. Excuse me.
Oh, thank you very much for taking my call, Mr. Chair and board members. My name is Stuart, S-T-U-A-R-T, Grenier, G-R-E-N-I-E-R. I'm on the Northeast Community Council in Muldoon, east side of Anchorage, and I'm speaking as a private citizen. The reason I'm calling is to request that the Senate Bill 64 include language that increases the penalties for those that provide alcohol through sale or other methods to people that are restricted from having alcohol. In other words, people that have been issued red stripes. I think the best way to do this is to make the legal code the same for the people with red stripes and for the underage, with equal penalties and billing at liquor stores. The reason I think this change is necessary is because it would facilitate an expanded use of issuing alcohol-restricted IDs to members of the community that are prone to public inebriation. What we have seen in Anchorage is the people that drive while under the influence are issued red stripes and experience the full force of the law. law that people without the resources to own a vehicle are allowed to get alcohol and find their way to wooded or public areas. They become intoxicated and become a problem for themselves and other citizens trying to use public spaces. By strengthening the wording for the alcohol-restricted licenses and posting it on the door for alcohol sales points, we will be getting the system ready for a more expanded use of the restricted licenses to include the chronic public inebriates. This will give communities a better handle on the problem and allow for the often homeless public inebriates the benefits of alcohol-restricted, in other words, red stripe licenses. I got into this issue about 5 years ago when there was a murder in the park next to my condo. And what had happened was the guy was incapacitated, and underage kids access alcohol through incapacitated public inebriates. They buy more than they can drink. The kids go into the park, and there's booze laying around, and they take it. Well, one thing leads to another, and next thing you know, the kids are going into the park and taking money from the public inebriates. And in the case of Centennial Park here in Muldoon, the kids went into the park after they took booze and took money, and they went in and killed the guy. What's happening is the public inebriates are access points for alcohol for the underage. If we could just get a more conspicuous billing of the red stripe license concept, the restricted licenses in the community, on the doors of the liquor stores, and make it synonymous with providing alcohol for the underage, completely synonymous in the legal code, it would be a very clear statement. If you get alcohol and you provide it to someone underage or someone who has a restricted license, there is consequences. Another case in my neighborhood, Officer Justin Willems was killed on the Glen Highway by an underage person who was provided alcohol by somebody outside a liquor store. The person who provided the alcohol did time. We need to start thinking about more responsibility in the community. And I think, especially after the vote, 4 years ago in Anchorage, where almost 70% of the electorate voted for universal carding for carrier alcohol purchases, I think the communities need to have these tools brushed up a little bit. The red stripe, it's kind of really discriminatory to say, okay, if you have enough money to drive drunk, to own a vehicle, you're going to get the full force of the law. But if you don't have the money to own a vehicle, and maybe you don't even have a home, well, your booze is over here and the woods are over there. Totally irresponsible. How many people froze to death? How many bodies are you finding on the Chester Creek Greenbelt? I think and I hope Senate Bill 64 addresses some of these changes. I know the Supreme Court says it's legal to be drunk in public. It's just illegal to drink in public. Well, eventually, I think we might want to go back and readdress that as a state. It will save us money in the long run. I hear all this talk about building prisons. Basically, we're getting people of all walks of life, of all races, but certainly from the bush, that are being banished from their own communities because they can't handle things like alcohol, and they're coming to Anchorage and in other parts of town, especially Fairview. I mean, who hasn't driven down Gamble and seen something that just says the community doesn't care about these people? We need to be more responsible, and I hope Senate Bill 64 addresses that. And if we could just get billing about the red stripe on the door right there with underage sales of alcohol, and it will become more conspicuous in the community, I think this is our best way to get a handle on this problem and help these people and help get our green belts and our parks back and keep these people out of the street. What's happening is wrong. I know people who were ran over because they drank too much, and I've been in a position like a lot of other people where should I go out on the road and grab this guy? You know, we need to work together. I hope Senate Bill 64 can address some of these issues, because if it doesn't, I think we'll just be back here next year and trying to do it right again.
Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning, Stuart.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there anyone else online who wanted to testify? Anyone else here in Juneau who wants to testify? Okay, we're going to go ahead and close public testimony. Okay, we've heard some good testimony. I appreciate that. Margaret, are you leaving? Do you need to leave? Or, I'm sorry, probably have the wrong name. Catherine. Yeah, I was going to ask Catherine or Christina or one of those that had previously testified to join us here at the table. If you can, if you need to leave, that's good too, or fine too. Okay, the public testimony is closed, so we're now at stage with this bill to ask questions of the sponsor and of folks. And obviously, this is the Finance Committee, so we're very concerned about the finances to fund this type of program. And, you know, I look at a lot of the components that make up the financial cost of this program. A lot of it has to do with probation officers and the 24/7 program, the PACE program, et cetera, et cetera. It just seems to me, though, that unless a person is ready and is willing and is accepting of treatment, it really is just a waste of money. Is that would you agree? And I mean, as a person in recovery, can you shed your thoughts on that, please?
I think that's true for some people. I mean, as a person in recovery, what got me into recovery is because of some pressure from the criminal justice system. So, I don't think that that's true for everybody. I think that having programs, spending money on some of these programs, will like be an intervention for many people and will get them at least in the direction toward the road to recovery.
Okay. And I appreciate that. And I understand the alternative is very expensive to not try and get people into treatment and to offer the 24/7 program and et cetera. It just seems that we hear stories where people will, yeah, I'll do treatment just so I can get out of jail earlier. I'll do this or that. And then they really don't take it serious because they don't have the desire and will to make the lifestyle change that's necessary to do full recovery. And obviously, you've done that. So I was just wanting to see if you could offer some help to us as a finance committee to make sure to fund a program like this that we are going to get the maximum value.
Well, I think what my understanding of what you're proposing and what you could potentially be funding for reentry programs, you're looking at programs that have many components to it besides just treatment, because just treatment is not going to do it. If you're funding programs and supporting programs that support, you know, that provide safe, sober housing, so like a safe environment, support systems like peer support, structure and help in getting a job and getting connected to pro-social people and activities and giving them opportunities to give back to the community. I mean, those are all of the things that are part of reentry programs. So I see a benefit in that. Just, you know, not just substance abuse treatment, but reentry programs that are like comprehensive, you know, including all of those elements.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And, you know, I think your comments was that while you were in jail, you got your master's degree. And so I'm here just visualizing that, well, you know, person, you know, could get their master's degree in jail, and of course we would...
In a halfway house.
And then, but yet still, you know, be an alcoholic or be addicted to drugs and still continue the life of crime. What? And you said it is the criminal justice system that encouraged you to get the treatment and the help that you needed.
I mean, it was my fear of what would happen if I didn't.
Okay.
Yeah. So. Okay.
Well, I think this program helps keep that fear in instilled. So.
But I also think that, I mean, I'm not a good representation of a majority of the people who are incarcerated. I mean, I think I represent kind of a minority of people there. I am higher functioning, I think, you know, just based on my experience, you know, and I had that support, which was, and I mean, I was totally plugged into a 12-step program. When I was in the halfway house, I wasn't on a phase level that would allow me the privilege to go to AA meetings. So, my AA, my fellowship people came to me at the halfway house and provided me support there. I mean, so that's just to kind of illustrate that the services weren't as accessible, but I had it in me to work it the way I needed to stay sober and get the support I needed. But not everybody is that resourceful, you know.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I don't see Kevin here anymore. I think he's actually been in jail a lot longer than you, and not that makes any difference. Okay, well, thank you, Catherine. Okay, so I'm going to ask the sponsor to come back, if, Jordan. Yeah. And then we'll take some committee questions from the committee, and then we're going to set this bill aside, work on a CS. Senator Kelly?
Jordan, I'm not sure what the mechanism is in the bill. Is there a way to separate the theft limit from property damage so that you could have one limit for theft and another limit for property damage?
Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Senator Kelly, yes. I think that would be possible.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, I think that, Senator Halpern?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I wonder if you could provide the committee with the concern that was mentioned by business that this would increase the crime. What are the crime rates of those states at the higher end, because I don't believe that is uniformly the case when you look at Indiana, Wisconsin, Connecticut, Pennsylvania. If we can get crime rates on theft and property values by those states, I think it could help the committee. And the point that I would like to point show the committee is the chart that you performed on Western states, their thresholds, the value of a U.S. dollar when we set it in 1978 was $500. Today, with inflation, if we set it at $750, we'll be $1,000 lower than what the inflation rate in 2011 was. So that amount is $1,730. So I think that this is a critical issue, especially in Alaska where the costs are so high. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people that are in prison that have felonies today that wouldn't have them if we had kept this level up with inflation.
Very, very good, Senator Hoffman. And frankly, too, I don't know how you determine the value of something. Is it the wholesale price or is it the retail price?
Good point. I think it's retail.
You know, because the store paid wholesale, obviously, and but they mark it up at retail. Anyway, we can work through that. Senator Fairclough, if you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just first on your comments, I wonder if we need information from an insurance company, because if I heard the chairman of FB, the acronym NFIB, there may be a threshold that the insurance company uses to reimburse the actual business. So I have a letter in here from, I hate acronyms, I'm sorry, from NFIB, telling me something about the money being directly out of the pocket of the business owner. So I'm wondering if the insurance and what the insurance company covers actually is playing in here, that if there's a felony, the insurance company is going to possibly repay all of the money under their insurance policy, but if it's a misdemeanor, the company may be having to incur those costs on their own. I don't know that to be true. I read the information that came into my file today. So, Mr. Chairman, my comment or question to you is that I hope in the CS that we're considering adding an audit provision with a sunset on it so that LBNA would take a look at the commission instead of standing up another organization that is out there in never-never land, that we only hear from them if there's problems, that we would actually take a look at them and review, should the bill pass, their functionality and whether they continue to perform a benefit to Alaska.
Well, that's a good point, Senator Fairclough. And as you know, we have lots of boards and commissions already. What's the thoughts of the committee on another board or commission? Or just we heard some testimony in favor of it, but Senator Fairclough, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, you know, one of the tasks with drawing money from savings to stand up our operating budget and our capital budget is trying to review and look at how Alaska invests its dollars to get the highest possible use out of each one of those dollars to benefit the people of Alaska. And so I'm wondering, and it may not be the case for this particular proposal, but is there some other group that is already stood up that works with recidivism and works with the correctional institution that might be able to handle this task versus bringing forward another commission?
Mayor Kelly.
Another thing we might consider is a task force that has a beginning and an end. It works to a specific outcome, and then it's over. Yeah.
Okay. All right. We'll consider the. We'll take input on the task force. You know, I'm looking at the fiscal note here. I just got to say, Jordan, the corrections one, 31 people is a lot of people to add. Now, I know you're a very people-oriented system here that you're recommending, and to do the follow-ups and the treatments and et cetera, takes a lot of people, but... And I don't want to recommend squeezing you to a point where it's ineffective. So any thoughts there?
Through the chair, you know, the Department of Corrections can probably speak better to what their needs would be, but how I've been describing it to people is that one probation officer, the salary and benefits that's required for them, pays for itself if they can keep two people out of jail for a year. So we hope to see savings from the additional personnel.
You know, and I believe you, but you don't know how many times we hear that if we just increase funding for education, there'll be less kids going to jail. And it all sounds good conceptually and theory, and I do believe it, but, okay, Senator Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that strikes me after listening to testimony is that we really want our correction officers as well as the Department of Corrections to do things differently. And so I'm not opposed to a one-time increment or maybe two, but the idea is not to add another layer of government but to actually change the direction that they're going. And so if I do believe sometimes you have to spend money to make money per se or to move a boat a different direction. But we really want the Department of Corrections to actually take the money that they're receiving and not use it just to lock people up, but to actually provide genuine rehabilitation inside of a correctional facility or divert folks from the correctional facility. So I'm okay with the one-time money and striking it further out so that it doesn't go forward for multiple years, that they actually have to... they have to change the way they do business.
I don't disagree. Although once you've hired people, it's hard to let them go. Senator Kelly?
To further what Senator Fairclough was saying, you know, we have a frustration with corrections, and I think we're not the first people to gather around the table. If you read in the history of corrections, it goes way back. They've never been able to figure out this question. Goes back to medieval times when they did bizarre things for punishment, and those never worked. And then you go the other direction, and you get lenient, and that doesn't work. And it just seems we can't ever get the answer. But when I was speaking with the young man that testified, Kevin, I think was his first name, out in the hallway, and I learned that you couldn't get treatment in the facility that he was in until you got close enough to your release date. And he said, there you are, you've made the decision to change your life. And sorry, you have to go out, you have to wait. We can't talk to you about those kinds of things until you get closer to your treatment date. And I think there's just all kinds of little hiccups in the system, that don't make sense, and they just go year after year. One of the reasons they go year after year is because we put these big walls of concrete between us and them. We don't really know what's going on in there, except we see in the movies it looks bad. And we hear reports about being way too lenient sometimes, and then we react, but we don't know. I'm not working towards a solution. I'm sorry I'm taking up the committee, so I'm just kind of rambling here, but it just seems like these kinds of questions are going to be very difficult to deal with. I applaud Senator Coghill's legislation, and I think we probably need about three more of these things that go into different aspects of corrections and treatment and how we charge and how we charge people.
Senator Bishop, please.
Along Senator Kelly's lines and Senator Fairclough's, you know, and we're talking about do we need another commission, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, if you want to have a benchmark on whether the program's working or not, I think if we're having to build another prison in about 5 years, that's if we are, it isn't working, and if we don't, then it is working. That's the bottom line. So it in the macro, I just have one quick follow-up for Jordan, Mr. Chairman.
Sure.
Jordan, I need a little help here on this. Is the 24/7 program, does that include the piece that if somebody's been convicted of a DUI where they could get a provisional to drive to work?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, those limited license provisions were removed in the Senate Judiciary CS, so they're not currently in the bill right now.
They're not currently in the bill, so that gets us back to square one, where that there's another barrier. That needs to be put back in my opinion, because what you know that don't help me. I got people that the wife's working, and they got to drive their husband 25 miles to work, and then get back to their work, and where the guy's really stepping up and been clean and sober for X, and it's just a barrier. I need some help on that one.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, I certainly agree. We worked very hard on those provisions. We ran into some drafting issues. Just some workability issues about how courts and DMV sync up, and it's something that we would have liked to have had in the bill, and I think that we're open to having it again, but considering the amount of days that we have left in session, we just opted to drop it from the bill and continue forward.
Jordan, it seems to me that don't the courts have the option of letting someone drive with the ignition interlock?
We do have mandatory interlock laws. The issue that we ran into with the limited license provisions was how you cancel or how you terminate an administrative license revocation compared to a court-ordered revocation. There was some difficulty syncing those two items up.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that's something we can revisit, though, Senator Bishop, and try to get that corrected. Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can we have the department come forward?
Which department?
Department of Corrections.
Corrections, okay. Yeah. We have several departments in the room here, so. Sir, if you could put your name on the record, please.
For the record, my name is Ron Taylor. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Corrections. I was hoping when Senator Fairclough asked that it was for a different department, but.
Thank you for the tours. Mr. Chairman, in 2008, I believe we passed legislation to create a task force on the council on reviewing domestic violence and sexual assault in our state. And one of the recommendations that continues to linger out there that I've contacted the Department of Corrections on for the last 5 years is the ability to provide treatment services while folks are incarcerated. And over that time, I've gotten different responses as to why we can't do it. The latest response has been from the department that it's because of funding. But when I talk to the judiciary system, they tell me that it's not funding, it's that someone has to actually be charged with a crime before they can enter into a treatment program, which appears to be what Senator Kelly was told from a former inmate today. And so I just want to know on the record, which is it? Is it money or is it judicially that we need to modify what the courts have the ability to do? So I guess maybe we need the Department of Law up here at the same time, or someone from the court system, because the answer to that question, one has to do with money and one has to do, it has to do with more than just money. And I want to know what it is, because I'm happy to put my shoulder to try to get it fixed, but you know, I'm getting a little frustrated since 2009, that recommendation not being implemented and people not receiving the treatment that they need while we actually have them in our walls before we release them. They should have the opportunity to succeed, and especially for rural Alaska. When a rural Alaska person is in an urban correctional facility, it is one time where treatment should be available, and currently they can't access it, and all of our inmates are suffering in different ways.
Senator Kelly, do you have a thought on that?
Well, I think one of the things Senator Fairclough is describing is the court's inability to impose treatment on someone who hasn't been sentenced yet. And so you could have 18 months, that was the number that was given to me, is that you'll have someone who needs treatment and is ready for treatment, but the courts can't impose it because they're going through the deals going back and forth, and time goes by when you're dealing particularly with a felony. And that's for short term. I'm not sure what the answer is for long term, if the judiciary has some restrictions on that as well, or if corrections does.
Mr. Chairman, if I could follow up, and I'll still look for the response. I haven't forgotten. But
he's hoping you did.
So it's frustration. I'm sure corrections is frustrated too. But through the chair, Senator Kelly, one of the ideas that I had that might be able to be incorporated into here is, if that is the case, why wouldn't we establish good time and provide a judge the flexibility to offer, if you take a program and if you can pay for the program yourself, I mean, there are people that actually have resources that could help offset it that are in corrections, and if not, then the state could provide it also, but why couldn't we offer that as part of a judge's determination to allow that as an option, so that we could let people go into treatment prior to being convicted, that it would be a retrospective for good time served or something. That I just look for direction from the judicial system to help us do that. But Deputy Commissioner Taylor.
Yeah, you know, and I tell you what, we're going to give you a lifeline, Deputy Commissioner. Nancy's here with courts, so Nancy can join you. But go ahead with your answer.
So does that mean that the lifeline gets the answer?
It's more like a wingman, Deputy Commissioner.
For the record, this is Nancy Mead with the Alaska court system, and to address through the chair the comment that was made by Senator Kelly, it is the case that the court can't require certain things of people until they're convicted. However, people want to get out on bail, and people do now propose some treatment during that bail period in order to get credit later towards their sentence. And that's addressed in this bill. The sponsor has the intent of broadening which sorts of treatment would qualify as credit for time served. I think it's Section 23. It's often called Nygren credit. But again, the court, until somebody is proven guilty, doesn't order somebody to do something, but as a condition of bail, the court can order somebody to do something. In other words, you either stay in jail or you can, for example, pay a fine, you can have a third-party custodian, and you need to go to ASAP, which is the DHSS's program, and if you don't do that, you would have violated some of your bail conditions, and you're put back in jail. So there are programs available for people before they are convicted. I hope that clarifies it.
Senator Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the only time that a person would remain in jail then that they hadn't made bail or bail wasn't allowed?
That's correct. There's a constitutional right to bail, and the judicial officer sets bail according to the weighing things like the severity of the crime and the threat to public safety versus the person's right to be out on bail, and sets then a dollar amount typically as well as any other conditions. For example, a common one is to have a third-party custodian, that is somebody that the court approves of to watch the person 24/7 to ensure that they return for their court dates and don't violate their other conditions of bail.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, so two things come to mind, one from a different bill that this committee had in front of us. We were wondering, let me just put it to me, I was wondering why we don't mandate inmates to file for their permanent fund dividend, or why the court doesn't direct inmates to apply, even though they would forfeit, their children might get that money.
Through the chair, Senator Faircloth, we actually have a court rule that in felony judgments, the people are required to apply for every year in which they are eligible. There's a state statute, I believe, that says that if you're incarcerated on a felony, you are not eligible. The money that would go for felons' permanent funds, in other words, the number of felons times the amount of that year's permanent fund, it is my understanding, goes to a separate fund that is used for by DOC, is my understanding, for some of their programs. So the people are ordered to, and they have to pay out of that a portion of their cost of appointed counsel if they had a public defender, and for our felonies, the rate at which people have public offenders is upwards of 90% anyway.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So to the sponsor, the bill sponsor, people who are incarcerated, I don't care whether they don't get it or not, they still should have to apply every year so that they know that they've disenfranchised their family of that money, and we should still be making them, as part of restitution, fill out the application, be it ever so painful, and be denied. We would have an accurate number in the court system, and they would start to see some impact on that. But back to what's in front of us today, I appreciate the court's perspective on that. Could I hear from the Department of Corrections on the availability of treatment? The issue inside of the task force was that the treatments that sometimes we provide in courts either are too short to be meaningful, which we heard today, or too long, and inmates are exiting the system before they can actually complete the program. And then when they go to a smaller community or somewhere that the program's not offered, then they become in violation. Then they have parole violations because they can't complete the treatment. So can you talk to me about the alignment as far as the weeks and time and then how we provide more services to meet the needs of those that are incarcerated so they really can stretch for that rehabilitation and that reentry into life?
Through the chair, to Senator Faircloth, I've actually been listening to all the conversations, and I have a couple of comments on that. First of all, as far as forcing or mandating somebody go into treatment, unless the parole board or the court actually orders them to do treatment, we can't force them to do treatment. A number of provisions that are in the bill currently would give us some way to incentivize those persons going into a treatment program. Certainly the 24/7 is a bail condition, and being able to look at PACE and other options would help us. The risk needs is a big component of this that would help us be able to identify who's best suited to go to treatment. Now, back to your original question, which is, have we improved in terms of offering treatment availability? Yes, we have over the past few years. We've expanded treatment significantly, and in fact, I'd be more than happy to provide you and the committee with what we've done in terms of expanding those services to individuals. But you've pointed out, and others have pointed out, that the number of problems that still exist with our treatment delivery system in custody. There are a number of areas throughout the state where we're not able to offer certain types of programming. We have limited programming in terms of the LSAT program and the RSAT program. We are looking, and we actually had a consultant come and look at our programs overall for ways that we can expand our treatment capacity and expand the way that we actually deliver services in treatment. Treatment in while persons are in custody. We certainly look at the risk and needs of that individual and do our best to align our services and our programs in custody with those risk and needs. Part of our problem has been, aside from like the past year or two, we haven't aligned those with our risk and needs, and I think that that's part of the frustration that you have received from us as a department, because we haven't aligned that, and we're doing that right now. So I'd be more than happy to provide you with what we're doing in terms of treatment in the institution. And we also have some treatment that we provide in the community as part of the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Go ahead, Senator Frankfurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, I appreciate that response, and I know that the department's got to be just as frustrated as those who've been working on the issues for more years than I have, certainly, so I applaud your efforts. One of the other items that I continue to talk to the Department of Corrections about year after year is reentry into the job to provide someone a job that is coming out of the prison system, that if they, it's just like domestic violence, if you're struck by economics, you tend to stay in the case of domestic violence, or in the case of being a felon, you steal or do whatever you do that has gotten you there. And so I'm wondering if the state is starting to look at, again, I've discussed it with the commissioner and others for years, a work reentry program where the state takes the first risk on the prisoner, the inmate that soon will be out into the community. Isn't there some place in the state system that is safe that we can give someone 6 months or a year's worth of work so that we're the first employer, that we bet on the job that we did inside of the correctional facility, that they're going to stay clean, that they're not going to steal, give them a living wage so that they can see what that looks like and be sort of the trial ground for reentry?
Through the chair to Senator Fairclough, you're certainly talking about apprenticeship programs that we've expanded over the past few years, our work with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development to look at pilot programs with the seafood industry, for example, where we have actually taken minimum security prisoners and taken them down to Kenai and Seward to actually do that work with the seafood industry so that they are able to make a living wage before they get out, and they have the wages to be able to support their families, to be able to pay restitution, pay child support, and to have first or second month's rent while they're out on the street. We are beginning to look at that. That's correct.
Thank you.
I think this is more to Jordan.
Before we leave, then, okay. Let me ask some additional questions. Okay. Before we go. Okay. So, corrections, you wrote the fiscal note, or somebody did. The 24/7 sobriety program, I see you have that down for $10 a day, and I think we heard testimony that in South Dakota it's $4 a day. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think South Dakota would say it was $2 a day. Okay. We had certainly been looking at this in terms of being able to look at ways within the department to reduce the cost of this. But what you have to understand, when we submitted this fiscal note, it was based on the current contract that we have in place with our working through our community jails and working through our electronic monitoring. That's what this was based on. And we can certainly go back and certainly have been looking at ways to reduce that cost. So that and this is the maximum amount. This is if the court had ordered all 2,400 into that program, which we know they're not going to order all 2,400 into the program. So that's what the fiscal note is based on, the maximum amount.
Okay. Yeah, and I understand it costs more to do things in Alaska, but five times seems to be a stretch. So let's rework that. Also, the PACE program. Can you explain? You got 11. I thought I read here 11 new people. 14.
Before we go to the PACE program, Mr. Chair, just to make sure that we understand, the those other programs in the other states are not connected to a community jail or the Department of Corrections electronic monitoring. They're going out to private entity and being able to offer that. And this is still for primarily the clients are paying for these services. This is not where the department is saying we need $4 million. This $4 million actually is receipt-supported services where the clients are actually paying for the majority of this money.
Okay, great.
And in terms of PACE, what we did was the initial pilot programs in Anchorage and Palmer, that was all done with existing resources. We did everything we could to make that work. And we start seeing some of the challenges in terms of having a PACE caseload where people are being violated a little bit more frequently. And yes, it's true, after the second, third violation, that goes down. But there's a lot of work that goes into supervising those persons, making sure that they're staying on track. And we do a much more intensive supervision for that group than we would for our traditional probationers and parolees. This is a statewide expansion of that to both probation and parole. So that means that we would be going into all of our communities where we have probation offices and anywhere where the parole board has ordered a person to reside and a probation officer to monitor that to ensure that that same type of swift, certain, and proportionate sanctions are being applied in those areas as well.
Okay, that's fine. I know just folks who are recovering, need support. And a lot of times they don't have the family, so you need to have your own folks that kind of check up on them and make sure. Like I said, it's a very people-intensive business you're in. Okay, and then finally, the Recidivism Reduction Grant Fund.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
You got six new positions there to write grants. Is that how I'm reading that? And what kind of grants would these be, and do we need that many people?
If the Department of Corrections has to do this, we have absolutely no infrastructure to do grants, and we're not a granting agency.
Have to do this?
I'm sorry, what was that, Mr. Chair?
You said if you have to do this, is somebody else could do this for you?
I'm sure there are other departments that do grants other than the Department of Corrections that would be available to possibly do this, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, like maybe Health and Human Services, or we'll ask the sponsor about that. Okay. Senator Kelly, did you have a question?
I want to go back to the 24/7 just for a moment on the fiscal note, and not necessarily anything technical in the fiscal note, but this envisions having the offenders pay for the cost of 24/7, which isn't necessarily a bad idea, but I'm just trying to think in terms of someone who has recently gotten out of jail. And the $10 we've established is probably pretty high. But what's this going to cost a month, $150 a month or something like that?
Through the chair to Senator Kelly, it would depend on how long they're on the program. Right. For certain, and it would be $10 a day, so that could be upwards of $300.
Well, then if it's $10 a day and it's 24/7, it's $300 per month. I go back to this young man that committed a felony way back when. He was 18 years old in a couple of months, and he was already married. And he was married and had two kids at the time. And he, like an idiot, does this felony, and away he goes. And he's gone for several years, and he comes back. And this guy has tried everything. He's not necessarily struggling with drugs. That's not what I'm talking about. He's tried everything to reintegrate himself into society and to do the right thing. He's got four fantastic kids. He's a great dad. It's like the success story that you would dream of if you were a counselor or someone in corrections. Yet this poor guy can't get ahead. He can't get a job. He can't get a CDL license. He can, nothing. Nothing. And this was a private sector decision, so they're free to make that. The company that he worked for, they loved him and moved him up through the ranks, and it came to this manager's position that they actually hired him for, and then found out he had to foul, he had to take the job away from him. Here's my point. You got four kids, you're trying, you can't afford $300 a month. It's tough. It's tough for most middle-class people to just say, hey, guess what, you have a $300 a month payment. And I know our philosophy when it comes to the perpetrators paying, and I agree with that to some extent, but I'd rather eat the fiscal note on this and just have us pay for it, because I got to believe there's more than $6 or $7 million of benefit to the state to have people who are sober. Senator Fairclough and I are way involved in fetal alcohol syndrome. Some of these people are going to get picked up, they'll be in the system, who would have otherwise been drinking and pregnant, who won't be drinking while they're pregnant because of this program. And we'll save at least $1 million on that, avoiding that pregnancy. So my point is, as we go forward here, we're asking the people to pay for this. I think for most of my life I would have said, yeah, we should make them pay, and it's their problem. I don't know, $300 a month, I think you could fail to come up with $300 a month and just kind of fade out of the system.
Yeah, Senator Kelly, as I mentioned, it's very people intensive, and it is very expensive, and we understand we do want to pay for this because it's a good program. We're just trying to figure out maybe a better, smarter way to do it. As the gentleman said, corrections isn't in the business of writing grants, but there are other departments that are, so we might be able to shave off a couple headcount there. Is there anything else before we bring up the sponsor? Did you have question, Senator Fairclough? Okay, Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Taylor, as somebody who has seen these essentially casualties on the other side of the wall, as Senator Kelly put it, we heard testimony this morning from Mr. Nettles that the people are well aware that there's a difference between having a misdemeanor versus a felon. Has that indeed been your experience as you look at these incarcerates that are behind there, that when they're going to steal something, they say, yes, I know this is a felony, I know this is a misdemeanor, and so I will take A over B or something to that effect? I mean, does that go through their mind? I'm having been to jail myself, but only there voluntarily as a physician, I have not been able to, I don't have that experience that you have. Can you just shed some light on that?
He doesn't have as much credit as he thinks.
Through the chair to Senator Olson, personally, and this is not as a department speaking, I would say if it was me and I'm deciding whether or not I'm going to steal for a misdemeanor or felony, I'm going to steal for a misdemeanor. It's cheaper if I get caught, especially. I'm not looking to steal for a felony. So for someone who is consciously making that decision, I think that they're trying to get as most as they can, but with the least risk as possible.
Mr. Chairman, that's not my question. My question is, does it even go through his mind that I'm going to be up against a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor? Or does he just take something that at least the simple-minded person would do? I need that. I want that. I deserve that. I'm taking it. And if I get caught, you know, I'll figure that out later.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, it's opportunity, and that's what they're doing. They're basing it off of opportunity. It's a timing and opportunity. I'm not sure that they are focused on whether it's a misdemeanor or felon.
So you disagree with Mr. As an experienced officer yourself, you disagree with Mr. Metal's.
I haven't had anybody come into my office to say I was trying to contemplate between a misdemeanor or felon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, Mr. Chairman, I can make some comments, but we can wait till the bill sponsor come up related to the felony threshold.
Okay. Anything else for the two folks with the Department of Law, Department of Corrections?
Excuse me, if it pleases the chair, I would
I would like a quick opportunity to address a question that came up the other day about the cost of felonies versus misdemeanors.
Sure.
Is this an appropriate time? Is that okay?
That'd be great.
Okay, I believe it was Senator Fairclough who did point to the fiscal note to say it is difficult to figure out the actual cost of felonies, of handling felonies versus misdemeanors. In general, the court has some system for doing that. We can... We know that a felony has increased juror costs. That's one of our biggest costs, for example. It's 12 jurors versus 6 for a misdemeanor. The average trial time for a felony is 4 days versus 2 for a misdemeanor. And the trial rate for felonies is somewhere closer to 4%, whereas for misdemeanors it's 1%. So we are able to, with appropriate data, do some sort of calculation of the cost of felonies versus the cost of misdemeanors. We also know that Superior Court judges and the caseload are different from misdemeanors, which are handled in district court. The problem with doing the actual mathematical computation for this change in the felony threshold is presumably a number of cases that were in the Superior Court as felonies, that is, those with stolen item valued at between $500 and $750, would move down into district court and be handled as misdemeanors. But our data comes in from the charging document as this is a Class C felony theft, and all we know in our data is the item is valued between $500 and $25,000. That's the range for a Class C felony. So we can't pull out the number of all those filings, and there are about 1,800 a year, that are the very low value items. And that's where we can't actually do the math, but you know, presumably some are and some would move down. I believe that many of those low level or thefts of small dollar items may be pled down quicker or dismissed by the prosecutor quicker because they're relatively minor. So I just wanted to explain why there isn't an actual dollar savings that we can compute.
Okay, I might just add too that Senator Dunleavy, that's your second offense on your telephone. So that's a Class C felony. It'll be, and that'll be double donuts for tomorrow.
Mr. Chair, that was a reminder that I thought the meeting ended at 11:45, and it was just reminding me of that fact. So
I see. Okay.
10:45.
I think we all like glazed. Senator Olson.
Ms. Mead, I guess one of the questions I do have, as you look at some of the issues that are out there, and we're talking about Superior Court versus District Court, do the magistrates ever deal with misdemeanors as well?
Magistrates can deal with misdemeanors. They're within the statutory jurisdiction of the district court. A magistrate can handle pretrial proceedings and misdemeanors and can handle the trial with the written consent of the defendant is how the statute is worded now.
Last question, Mr. Chairman, has to do with, would that indeed, or are you able to go ahead and say that that would indeed save the state money if the threshold was higher for the felony amount because more people would be going to see the magistrate or the district court judge?
Again, presumably, if the question is whether cases where the item stolen is between $500 and $750 are already something that the DAs decide not to file as a felony, and we can't know the facts of that, but I mean, the implication or impliedly, some cases would be handled as misdemeanors instead of felonies, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If I could follow up on that, when a police officer comes to respond to a shoplifting call, and let's say it's a cart full of meat and it's over $500, do they have to do more work knowing that it's going to be a felony charge versus a misdemeanor charge?
To the chair, I think I would defer to the Department of Public Safety or even Department of Law on that question. I'm not sure exactly what process they go through before they refer it to the District Attorney's Office for prosecution.
Okay, thank you. Okay, anything else for these folks? If not, let's get this sponsor back up quick, and then we'll adjourn for the day. Thank you. Okay, Jordan, Senator Fairclough has a question for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the issue of the fiscal note and the where you're showing that receipts will pay for the 24/7, I'm wondering if there's any... has there been discussion about the pay issue that Senator Kelly brought up? And what I mean, isn't that a form of discrimination if people can't if they don't have equal resources economically to be able to get out on bail, and then they're stuck in a jail because they can't pay, that seems inappropriate. Has that been discussed?
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, or Jordan Schilling, staff to Senator Coghill. Senator Fairclough, my understanding is that they cannot be taken back to jail simply because of their inability to pay. That you're right, that would be unfair. I think one of the risks of charging offenders $10 a day is the fact that, as Senator Kelly said, they wouldn't be able to pay it in some cases. Some people can't afford $300 a month. And so in the event that that occurs, it's going to be the department that has to foot the rest of the bill. The bill does have, Senate Bill 64 has an indigency clause in there so that if someone can't afford, the department foots the bill. So in this case, that could happen, I suppose.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can't afford, will that be then defined somewhere? Because can't afford, if you have five kids I think it was four or five that Senator Kelly was referring to, you might have income coming in if you're able to work, and if that infraction hasn't caused you to lose your job, or you still can drive to work depending on what's happening to you.
Through the chair, Senator Fairclough, the Department of Corrections and courts are familiar with indigency waivers. They're using them today for other things. They could probably speak better to how they determine what someone's income is and what their ability to pay is.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm happy that you've discussed it.
Okay. Well, very good. I think we had good discussion on this bill. It's a very important bill. It's a very expensive bill. But the better part is I think it can help change lives for the better. So it's something we're going to continue to work on. If members do have any suggestions for some changes, please give them to Christine behind me here. And otherwise, Senator Kelly, gas tonight, gas bill?
Yeah, we're scheduled for 5 o'clock.
Okay. Are you going to be ready? Okay. All right, then we're going to adjourn this meeting, come back at 5 o'clock, and take up Senate Bill 138.